Hello, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's Tuesday, the 5th of May, 2009, and I'm your host, Herewood Fenton. Tonight, we're looking at genetically modified foods. There's a controversy, and there's a movement to change our practices, to have genetically modified foods correctly labelled, and to have the farming practices completely reversed. We'll be talking to a man from an organisation which is leading the charge against Monsanto and other organisations which are trying to bring genetically modified seed into the country. Later in the show, we'll be taking another look at the swine flu epidemic, or perhaps hoax, depending on how you want to look at it. And we'll be examining the vaccine debate with a close look at a recent Channel 7 debate that was broadcast, and we'll be criticising and analysing the way in which the mainstream media has dealt with the question of parental choice over vaccination. So I welcome you to the show, and this is going to be really a very special night, and I hope that you can enjoy it and get back to us with any comments and feedback you may have. Okay, I have with me tonight Bob Phelps, who is the Executive Director of Gene Ethics, geneethics.org, www.geneethics.org. And I'll just read to you briefly from the mission statement on the website. Gene Ethics is a non-profit educational network of citizens and kindred groups, and we want the precautionary principle, scientific evidence, and the law rigorously applied to all proposed uses of genetic manipulation technologies and their products. The whole issue of genetically modified foods is one which we've covered briefly in some episodes of Truth News here, but we're going to be talking about it more, and this is in the context of a film which We Are Change Sydney is screening on the 16th of May. And I've been in touch with several groups in Australia who are opposed to genetically modified foods and are working to try and bring information to the general public to explain why. And tonight I'd like to welcome Bob to the show. And Bob, it's great to have you on the show. Good evening.
It's a pleasure to be here, Herewood. Thanks for inviting me.
Excellent. Yeah. Now, Bob, it'd be great if you could give us a little bit of a history. I'm not very well educated on the subject of GM foods. I really didn't understand it at all, probably until about a year ago. And since then, I've watched a couple of films. I've understood that it's a much more complex subject than I first understood. And it, to me, if I just summarise the way I see it at present, is that it really seems to cut across several different aspects of things that we should be concerned about. One of them being like large corporate monopolies, which are taking away the freedom of our society to function in economically the way we should as a democracy. The other is the freedom of people to choose what sort of foods they eat because of this monopolization. And another aspect of it appears to me to be the collusion of government with the large corporations, and in this case it seems to be mainly one, being Monsanto. And so there's this collusion of government and corporate power, monopolization, restrictions on freedom. And from the perspective of what we cover here on Truth News, this is a few years ago, many years ago, the dictator Mussolini, described the definition of fascism as being a merger of corporate and government power. And this is one of the reasons why I'm particularly interested in this issue, because it seems to be one of these cases where, you know, that you've got government and corporations going hand in hand and really dominating and preventing people from being able to make their own decisions. So you know, that's my current perspective on it. And I'll just hand it over to you to give us your own perspective historically and where you come into the whole picture.
Yes, well, it certainly does have those geopolitical aspects that you've talked about. This is a technology that's been under development for a very long time. The work was done at the same time when scientists were deconstructing matter to create chain reactions that led to atomic bombs and nuclear weapons. So between the world wars, they were also thinking about how they could deconstruct the biological world to use its powers and its materials for industrial purposes. And of course, the trend throughout the 20th century was greater miniaturization and greater thinking at the microscopic level. We now have, of course, emerging a whole range of new nanomaterials which operate at the cellular and subcellular level as well. And so all of these trends have been going on in parallel. And I guess the watershed for genetics was the discovery, or the description, should I say, in 1952 by Watson and Crick of the double helix, the shape of DNA, and subsequent to that, the development of technologies that would allow scientists using laboratory techniques to cut and paste the codes of life between different organisms that were unrelated to each other. Human beings had been developing through agriculture and the using traditional breeding and so on, the wonderful array of food and fiber crops and organisms, animals, crops and microorganisms that modern society feeds, houses and clothes itself using. And that was within species boundaries, broadly speaking, over the last, say, 5 to 10,000 years, arising initially out of the Middle East and moving worldwide. But then, of course, when gene manipulation came along and scientists and industry thought they could then deconstruct nature and start cutting and pasting the codes of life between different organisms to make new and more valuable products, that's how it was conceived, and that's been the enterprise which has now become a laboratory tool, of course, a set of laboratory techniques for manipulating living organisms, but also, of course, a set of products, genetically manipulated crop plants, genetically manipulated microorganisms that are kept in factory vats for the production of a variety of different drugs and food products, say human insulin, just to take one example, which is produced using genetically manipulated microorganisms kept in large vats in factories. The product is harvested, the organisms remain in that enclosed environment and continue to produce that particular substance. Our concern begins to arise when you deliberately take organisms and release them into open environments, and then you start to challenge natural processes and systems with a new living organism that hasn't been out there before, the behavior of which may be unpredictable and dangerous. And, right. Of course, as you've said, also gives rise to those geopolitical pressures of ownership and control, monopoly, and the nexus of power between governments and industry.
So they're really closely interrelated.
Industry and governments controlling the global food supply, for instance.
Okay, yeah. So like there seems like a very closely interrelated thing of the sort of political aspect of it and the science, and the science being fairly new. I mean, this probably took off in the late 70s. Would that be about right? Like when this, the whole recombinant DNA techniques and everything took off, and various branches of that went into different, I guess, technologies. We seem to have lost our connection to Bob Phelps. I will attempt to reconnect. Please stand by. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, we're back with Truth News Radio Australia, and I am interviewing tonight Bob Phelps, Executive Director of GeneEthics.org. Welcome back. We run on a smell of an oily rag, so things aren't always very reliable. Although we've had remarkably good success with our technology here, but every now and then things go down. Now, Bob, just before we, in the last segment, you were getting into this whole question of technology and the development of science and how that kind of, like, converges with issues which are to do with, you know, politics and geopolitics. And I think this is a really interesting topic, and it's one which can be confusing because all of these things have occurred in a fairly tight timeline. And I was just before we got cut off, I was actually asking about the question of when did this technology start to really take off, and I think it's around about the late 1970s. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And since then, it's been really accelerating in a whole lot of different directions. One of them being genetically modified foods, but of course, there's all the other aspects of recombinant DNA techniques that have been used for so many different things. Some of which are probably very positive, and, you know, have great potential. And how do we evaluate what is worthwhile and what is not worthwhile, and how do we regulate the behavior of large organizations that seek to use these technologies for a profit basis?
Well, if we're talking about transnational companies, I mean, you know, the agrochemical industry, the drug industry, and all the other big industries are only reined in by, you know, rather unsatisfactorily by governments, really. You've got the banks on strike in the USA at the moment and receiving enormous handouts from the public purse, which strikes me as very counterintuitive. You know, in a system that where the ideology says that, you know, businesses are allowed to do what they like and they're allowed to prosper how they can, when they hit hard times and go on strike and refuse to lend money, which is what their ordinary function is, just like they supply money, like a water utility supplies water and electric utilities supply electricity, I see them as having gone on strike. Well, you let them go to the wall, I think, and you get a new set of rules about how the whole thing's going to function. And I think it's the same if we were talking about the food supply and people like Monsanto, that we can't afford to have one company owning a disproportionate amount of the world's biological material.
But it's really rampant,
therefore controlling the global food supply.
It's just rampant profiteering, isn't it? I mean, at one level, it just seems like it's the profit motive taken to the nth degree. And
well, unfortunately, that's how modern capitalism is structured, or has been structured, and so social responsibility really has gone out the window. I mean, I'm not saying that all corporations are conscienceless and bad or evil, but when you're just focusing on paying your executives huge bonuses and you pay those people to primarily focus on returning as big a profits as they can to the shareholders of the corporation, then there's something dramatically going to go wrong, because their charter to serve society and the and to meet human needs is going to be put on the back burner. And so in the case of feeding the world, for example, I think we're venturing into very difficult and clearly troublesome times when we consider that at the moment broadacre agriculture is run like a factory. It's been industrialised over the last 60 or 70 years to the point where it's totally oil dependent. Now, oil is going to be running out sometime soon, so we do have to get new systems in place, and it'd be very wise of us to do it sooner rather than later, because we're already getting messages that 1 billion people, more than 20% of the world's human population, are either starving or malnourished, while a similar number are obese and stuffing their faces the whole time.
Yeah.
Australia throws 40% of its food in the waste bin. There's something seriously wrong with the distribution of resources when this is happening. We see that using genetically manipulated crops, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay and other countries in Latin America are being used as a factory to produce animal fodder for feedlots in North America, so that animals can be raised in horribly inhumane conditions on feedstuffs that are produced solely for the purpose of feeding those animals. And then, of course, given their living conditions, you have to pump them full of pharmaceuticals and so on, which is not in the public interest either, because other organisms then become resistant. So this style of agriculture, this industrialized system, is not going to survive. The thing on which it depends, oil, is running out, and it's wrong-headed in any event. We need to be nurturing biodiversity. We need to be farming sustainably, so that our soils, water, and our vegetation in natural landscapes and also cultivated landscapes managed in a way that is going to see not only this generation but future generations also be able to clothe, feed and house themselves using those resources. But if we continue as we are, as CSIRO Land and Water under the tutelage of John Williams had been warning for at least a decade before he retired and joined the Wentworth group of scientists, this country will not be able to feed itself if we continue down this path in as little as perhaps 20 or 30 years. Our soils and our water will be so depleted that we will be dependent on others, on imported foods, to feed ourselves, and that's not in the public interest. In fact, it's been, of course, federal government policy, and I think it remains the policy, to rely on global free trade in food to ensure that this nation is able to feed itself. And that is not sustainable either. That's going to be quite impossible to continue to transport vast amounts of food around the world as we're doing at the moment, at great expense of energy and other resources.
Indeed. Bob, how do you respond to the, the promotional aspect of genetically modified foods, that, these techniques are for our benefit because they, they've enhanced production? Because this obviously is the way in which Monsanto would project that this is something positive rather than something negative. Just from my point of view, I have to say, I didn't know until fairly recently that their flagship product was a product that was designed simply to be resistant to another product that they sell, which is Roundup. Now, that, I don't think a lot of people are aware of that was one of the first things that they developed, was their Roundup-ready products. And, I guess on some level it sounds good. Yeah, sure, it saves trouble for the farmer. You can just spray Roundup all over the place and you don't have to worry about killing the plants, you'll just kill the weeds. But something wrong with that idea on a very basic level when you start to think about it, on a common sense level, I don't know.
It's profoundly flawed, and indeed we've got Steve Powles, who's the leading weed scientist at the University of Western Australia, just in the last week or so in the national rural media warning that Australia could very well go down the same track as Argentina and Brazil, where and North America, where there are now probably 10 or a dozen major weed species that tolerate being sprayed with Roundup. So Roundup is,
now, is
far
it,
and away the most commonly used herbicide in the world. And, of course, it was assumed and it was said by Monsanto, oh, this, the plants are never going to develop resistance to Roundup. We have multi-resistant ryegrasses, including resistant to Roundup in Australia already. We have other weeds that will resist Roundup. And very soon we're going to have weeds related to genetically manipulated canola Roundup tolerant as well, because the canola that's being grown, the GM canola, tolerates being sprayed with Roundup. And it will outcross, its pollen will spread to those weedy relatives. And we're going to have weeds on roadsides in disturbed environments like parks,
so these super weeds,
street sides and so on, that are going to be unmanageable.
They call them super weeds.
Well, you know, that's just a catchphrase for it. But really, they're weeds that, I mean, another view, of course, a more sensible view, I think, is the view being taken by Peter Andrews, which has developed the a different concept of landscape management, which really sees weeds as part of the process. Weeds prosper in poor environments, but as they enrich the environment, which they do by drawing the nutrients up from the lower soils and creating fertility, then other species come in afterwards. This is a very, this sort of succession is a very common ecological principle. And in his practice on his own farms and in the farms that he's been developing with this landscape management, these landscape management techniques to look after the soil, to look after the water management as it was originally designed to operate in a very flat continent, Australia, and to manage the vegetation appropriately, you don't spend huge amounts of money on herbicides. You take the weeds into account and you manage your soils so that their fertility nurtures the plants that come along after weeds in the succession. And these systems approaches can work. These are the sorts of systems that organic agriculturalists use commonly, and they certainly are sustainable. They're low environmental impact and they do work. They're productive, and the vast majority of the peoples of the world are still fed by themselves using principally organic techniques. So it's what we did for thousands of years. We can do it again. It can be productive enough. And multi-cropping rather than monocultures of the kind that we see out in the countryside here will be the way to go, where you put in a variety of different food and fibre crops working together to make a somewhat natural ecosystem. We don't need to have GM. Well, another recent report by the Union of Concerned Scientists has just done an analysis of all the evidence to date, which is now 13 or 14 years of evidence from North and South America, about the yield potential of genetically manipulated crops. And they've concluded that with the exception of the crops soybean, corn, canola and cotton, which have had a toxin gene put into them so that they will control insect pests, with exception of a very small increase in productivity from those so-called BT insect toxin crops, particularly corn and soybean, with the exception of that, all of the other genetically manipulated crops, which are principally the Roundup tolerant ones, again, soybean, corn, canola and cotton, have actually yielded less than their conventional counterparts. And indeed, that's borne out by the evidence from the growing of GM canola in Australia last year. The conventional canola far outstripped the GM varieties, and the GM varieties did more or less as well as the other herbicide tolerant varieties, Clearfield and Triazine tolerant.
That is an extraordinary piece of information. I mean, I really find this. I mean, I hope that our listeners can reflect on this. That, I mean, we're really talking here about a case of a technology which is vastly expensive to develop, which appears to be degrading rather than even improving the very thing that it's focused on. Are you? Have you had debates on this with proponents of the official, position on this from government organisations to industry? And I'm just wondering, like, where you come from in terms of your background and knowledge. Like, do you feel confident in basically taking them on and saying, well, no, you're wrong? I mean, what is your sort of background, Bob? Like, I should have probably introduced in more detail there at the beginning, but what is your actual history
an environmental campaigner most of my working life, which is 40 years.
Yeah.
Working on nuclear issues first, and for the last 20 years on gene manipulation issues. So I don't pretend to be a bench scientist, but one of the things that science tries to do is exclude so-called non-experts from the public discussion about these things.
Indeed.
And of course that's totally phony, because most of the issues are environmental, social, ethical, economic, and whether or not the technology works is really a bit of a side issue. Whether it's safe or not, well, that's an issue, of course. But gene manipulation technology works okay in the laboratory, but it doesn't work in the environment. GM crops are a dud. They don't do what they promise. And really, the huge, enormous amounts of money, both public money and private money, have been invested in them. Of the order of $100 billion. We're talking real money.
It's extraordinary.
Monsanto, of course, wanted to transform itself from being an agrochemical company because it recognized that the tide was turning against chemicals, because they've polluted our environment, they degrade the health of living organisms, including human beings. And their days are numbered, because most of them are all oil-based. Oil is running out. Really, we have to get off the chemical bandwagon. But meanwhile, Monsanto's got this incredible cash cow, Roundup, which is the most used agricultural chemical in the world. It's the next 10 chemicals don't sell as much as together, combined, as Roundup. It's just incredible. So
that is incredible.
It's been enormously profitable for Monsanto, and they've believed that genetic manipulation was the way of the future, and if they poured the profits from Roundup into GM, they would get the result. But the technology doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is that it's based on a wrong-headed notion of genetics. Watson and Crick described the functioning of DNA and so on in 1952, as I mentioned, saying that one gene produces one RNA, produces one protein, that there would be this linear relationship. And indeed, when our scientists went hunting for the answers in the human genome, they'd expected to find 100,000 genes. But bingo, they only found 30,000. And if there was conclusive proof needed, which they really already knew long before that, that genes are an extraordinarily complex interacting system where a multitude of different genetic components can be involved in one particular characteristic, say eye colour, or the colour of your hair, or the shape of your face, or any characteristic of any organism. Most of them, with the exception of a few like herbicide tolerance, the BT toxins and something like cystic fibrosis, a disease of human beings, are mostly not mediated by single genes. It's only those few exceptions that are. So take the promise of GM crops, drought tolerant, salt tolerant, able to fix nitrogen,
right,
etc.
These are complex.
Are not going to come true because they don't depend on single genes, and all that GM can do is cut and paste a single gene from, say, a soil bacterium into a crop plant to confer Roundup tolerance.
But just if we can get back to that issue of Roundup tolerance again, it sounds like what's happening with the weeds is that the weeds are actually crossbreeding. There is actually some genetic material entering the weeds that is borrowed from the genetically modified crop. Is that what's happening here? Or is it just that the weeds are becoming resistant by another mechanism of natural selection?
Well, there are two. There's the natural selection mechanism. Of course, if you apply a chemical in the environment or anything that kills an organism, then there will be survivors. You might get 99.99% of them the first time round. You might kill, take the rabbit, right? Myxomatosis.
Yeah.
Okay, very effective killer of rabbits, right? Got 99.99% of the rabbits. But the survivors were resistant to Myxo. That's why they survived. And next year, they bred.
Right.
And very soon, you were back to square one. You had the same problem. Same problem with the caliche virus, which was another virus that was released to try to combat rabbits. The same thing. It doesn't work because the survivors are resistant. So that's the natural selection process. And it's the same with weeds. If you spray the weeds with Roundup, then the ones that aren't killed are the ones that will have the gene, some genetic component or makeup, which allows them to survive being sprayed with a chemical that will kill almost anything green. But there are a few survivors.
Right.
And so that's the first mechanism, and that's what, of course, rather stupidly, land managers have done with Roundup. They've overused a good thing, just
right,
as we've overused antibiotics, and now we have antibiotic-resistant superbugs in hospitals and things that kill people.
And, of course, the Roundup-ready corn and soy would only encourage them to overuse it because...
To spray more, of course.
Yeah,
of course,
yeah.
Because it's an easy management tool.
Yeah.
But the second mechanism, as you've alluded to, is that the pollen of the genetically manipulated variety will go up to 20 kilometres or so on the wind or be carried by bees. And if that bee lands on a related plant, and that plant could be, by chance, a wild radish, a wild turnip, or a charlock in the Australian context, for instance, then it's possible that plant will get the pollen, get the gene, and itself, its offspring, it will set seed, and those seed will contain the herbicide tolerance gene, and then you will have Roundup resistant weeds in your environment. So there are two mechanisms, both working together, both ensuring that before very long, any chemical, and it could be any of the herbicides that we're talking about, or in the case of insecticides, the same thing. The insect will adapt very soon if you overuse a chemical against them, that those things adapt as nature does to survive. Any organism will adapt to survive, and that's what happens in the case of weeds or insect pests.
And so that leads me to the next part of this question, which we haven't touched on yet, is, okay, we can see that there is this problem with genetic possible genetic mutations or genetic material transferring between plants. there is the problem of the weeds becoming tolerant through overuse of Roundup, for example. But then there is also evidence that's been a few whistleblowers, a few scientists, and in the film that we're going to be showing in Sydney, The World According to Monsanto, you'll see that, that there is strong evidence that the genetically modified food is not necessarily totally safe. Can you speak to that at all? Because there's quite a lot of information that's come out, and what I've seen is reports of experiments that were actually done by Monsanto, which were then suppressed, that showed rats had increased liver size and increased mortality from eating the genetically modified soy, and possibly there are other things. Can you enlighten us on that at all?
Sure. Well, it's now clear that some genetically manipulated foods do have an adverse impact on the health of experimental animals. Whether they've had an impact on human health is another question. We do, however, know that from the 1980s there was one of those products produced in a factory of the kind that I talked about before, a food supplement called L-tryptophan, which was produced by a Japanese company, Showa Denko, that was contaminated with a highly toxic substance which did kill and maim a number of people. We're talking initially about 5,000 people in the USA, of whom some died, around about 40 or 50 initially and some later, and some 1,500 people were permanently disabled with central nervous system disorders. So that was an example of something gone seriously wrong with certainly the filtration of the product. Now, there's still an argument brewing about whether it was to do with the genetically manipulated organisms or not. From our perspective and from the reports of the US Food and Drug Administration and others, it is clear that the genetic manipulation of that microorganism was implicated in the production of that chemical, and it was in the product, and it did maim and kill people. So that's an example. But the other examples are particularly the feeding studies, some of them done by the company itself, and some done independently, do indicate that, for instance, an experiment with genetically manipulated potato in the UK showed that experimental animals were injured by those gene manipulated potatoes. Roundup Ready soybean has been used in some experiments, and the most interesting of those and the most recent are experiments in which observations were not only made of the animals that were actually fed the product, but also of their offspring and their offspring, so two or three generations from the original feeding of the Roundup Ready soy, and stunting of growth, low fertility, and other impacts on the health of those subsequent generations of animals has been found and now confirmed, most recently by a study done, commissioned by the Austrian government. So I think there is credible evidence that at least some genetically manipulated foods are unsafe. There is a local example as well. T.J. Higgins, the deputy head of the CSIRO plant industry here in Australia, worked for around about a decade on introducing a bean gene into field peas. Field peas are a crop that are used as an animal fodder, and it was thought that the weevil, which often infested the peas and made them much less productive, could be dealt with by introducing this gene into the field peas. First feeding studies that were done were with farm animals, and they found that indeed the farm animals didn't prosper when they were fed the field peas. They actually lost weight and lost condition, and that experiment was cancelled and was seen as a failure. And then, inexplicably, CSIRO decided to submit some of the field peas to a team of analysts at ANU who did an experiment, a feeding study, and indeed found that they were highly toxic to experimental animals as well. We can only assume or speculate that there was some idea that perhaps because animals couldn't digest the field peas and didn't put on condition, that they had an idea that they might introduce them into the human food supply as a, say, a treatment for obesity, for instance, a product that would pass right through you rather than being digested so that you wouldn't gain weight. In any event, it was found to be highly toxic. The whole project was cancelled. A lot of public money was and a lot of time was spent on it, but it did, I think, further confirm that some genetically manipulated foods are not safe to eat.
It's interesting you mentioned that kind of like a side effect of the food was considered to be maybe, you know, exploited for another purpose. This is something that I've noticed with the pharmaceutical industry a lot, is that quite often a product or a drug is developed that has one purpose, and then someone finds, hey, it does this. Maybe we can market it as something else. So I don't know if you're aware that Prozac, the drug Prozac, was originally developed as a diet drug. And for certain, for some reasons, it was dropped. But there was another aspect to the functioning of Prozac, which later, you know, made it, you know, best-selling antidepressant. But these types of things, you know, they again reflect back on that there's a business angle all the time that these people are looking at, which is
well,
not always in our best
marketing,
interest.
You know, you can't get away from it. That's embedded in capitalist society, isn't
yeah,
it? That if you've got a product, you've got to try and find the market for it. And if the market you thought was appropriate for it doesn't turn out to be the right one or doesn't want the product, then you look somewhere else, whether it's a pot of jam or a Porsche. You know, you're no good having a product for which there's no market. So
I mean, it sounds reasonable, and I'm certainly not against the idea of a free market. I'm not, like, I don't think total regulation and rigid, you know, socialized system would necessarily solve our problems either, because that could easily become corrupted by power from having a highly centralized system. And you know, I mean, I'm sort of a believer in a kind of a radical free market approach, but that really requires vigilance, I think, from everyone on a very kind of grassroots level to prevent the forming of giant, you know, control
systems.
I think
one of the problems is that our regulators are tame cats.
Right.
Regulators are put there to facilitate the deployment of new commodities and products, not to seriously and trouble their passage into the market. I mentioned nanomaterials earlier on. Nanomaterials are now appearing in a whole raft of different products, and I'm afraid that our food and agrochemical and industrial chemical regulators are taking a very low-key attitude to this, because governments are putting an enormous amount of money into the development of nanomaterials as the next engine of economic development, just as they did with gene manipulation 10 years ago when they were pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into research and development of GM. Right. They're now doing the same with nanomaterials. We've seen, for instance, that the money that the Howard government put into promoting gene manipulation technologies, they set up an outfit called Biotechnology Australia, which was controlled, let's say, by five different departments within the federal government. Its mandate ended on July the 1st last year, or on June the 30th, should I say. And on July 1, Biotechnology Australia became Nanotechnology Australia. It's in the Department of Industry, and
nice.
It's there for the purpose of promoting nanomaterials and for getting them as fast as possible out into the public domain. with a minimum of hindrance from regulators. You see, the problem is that our regulatory systems are not scientific in any meaningful sense. They are what you would, what they say is science-based. So it means that they don't set any benchmarks or standards by which to objectively judge whether something's safe or not. You know, if you had benchmarks and standards against which you would measure any data that came forward from the company or the applicant or from anywhere else, then you'd be starting to have some objective way of saying, well, yes, there's enough evidence to say that, that we're pretty sure that this is safe.
But of course, they're always citing studies. I mean, there's endless studies that are done, and they always say, well, here's a study that shows that this is safe, you know.
Yes, but it's always state of the art. That's the problem. There's nothing ever final about this. And we can understand that scientific knowledge is provisional. But if the system for judging the products of science and technology are not themselves objective and rigorous, then you can submit any suite of so-called scientific information that you like, including shonky feeding studies done by the companies themselves, which are, you know, judged to be sufficient and good enough for the purpose of ensuring the safety of the food or the product that happens to be coming to market. It's not good enough because these sorts of studies always get the result that the company wants. Otherwise, they wouldn't be published. They're not peer-reviewed.
Right.
And the objective standards of science are not applied to them. Now, the other thing that, regulators always say, and this is how they get around the problem of insufficient evidence, is, well, we think that this is a manageable risk. This risk is manageable, and therefore we're going to license this genetically manipulated product or this chemical or this drug to come into the marketplace. But the problem is that in most cases, no one is mandated to actually do the management. Particularly in the food supply, we have the federal government setting policy for what should happen about labelling and about assessment and about the standards of the food supply. The enforcement is done by local councils who have no capacity or expertise to do that at all. And state governments have a role, but a rather marginal role, in the whole enforcement and management of food standards and safety as well. So
we just don't have a regulatory
system. The risk is acceptable and the risk is manageable. But if there's nobody to manage it, what companies sensibly do is they hedge their bets. They build into the price of their product, whether it's asbestos, for instance, they build in a little bit extra so that when things go belly up and people start to get sick or die, they've got that buffer that they can then say, oh, well, sorry, we made a mistake. Here, we'll set up a fund and we'll pay you out, or our insurance company will cover it.
Right.
But what we need is a precautionary approach, an approach that says, look, you've got to have objective standards for the quality, for the scope, for the scale of the evidence that you bring forward in order to make an application for your product. And if you don't measure up, you don't get the approval. And it's got to be very highly challenging, and it's got to be very objective, and it's got to be objectively applied. And if you don't jump over those hurdles, then your product just doesn't hit the market. And it's got to be precautionary. You know, if we don't know enough, then go away and do more science, get more evidence.
Is there a problem with
that your product is safe? That doesn't go on with our regulators at the moment.
Is there a problem, Bob, with vested interests in universities and research bodies, as there is with, you know, many other issues, where the industry has basically invested in, you know, research arms of academic institutions?
Well, that's the same everywhere. Even the most highly regarded scientific body in Australia, CSIRO, is required to get 40% of its funding from outside sources.
Right.
And so it's required to get it from who? Does it get it from? Well, of course it writes contracts with Monsanto and Bayer and the drug industry and the
nano industry, whatever industry it needs.
And then, of course, who calls the shots? Who sets the research priorities? Who says what research is going to be done? Of course, the people who are paying the bills get to do that. And yes, so unfortunately, science is profoundly compromised from beginning to end these days, and is mostly in the service of commercial and corporate interests.
Do you have any allies within the CSIRO in terms of what you're promoting?
Not presently. I mean, the people who would be our allies, one, for example, Martin Stapper, who was a soil scientist within CSIRO plant industry, got moved on about 18 months ago as a result of his views about GM crops, because he was in the course of going out and giving private lectures to organic and other farmers about the need to nurture their soils and so on, was making comments about his opposition to the deployment of genetically manipulated crops in Australia, and he was invited to leave CSIRO as a result after 30 years of good and faithful service in CSIRO plant industry. So there are many, many cases. Arpad Pushtai, who was top-level scientist in his toxicological field in the UK, who was the guy who was asked to do the study of the GM potatoes. And to his surprise, being a supporter of GM himself, found that, in fact, the experimental animals were undeniably harmed by the product that he fed them. And when the evidence became so overwhelming that he couldn't deny it any longer, and his superiors wouldn't let him go public with what he knew, he went on TV and told the world and was sacked the next day. You know, we've got another example of a visitor that we hope to get to Australia shortly, Shiv Chopra, who was a senior official in the Canadian government, and some of his colleagues who were brought under pressure to give approval to Monsanto's bovine growth hormone, Posilac, even though they knew that there was good evidence that it would cause harm to animal health and that it wasn't safe in the human food supply, were brought under pressure both by the corporation and the government to approve it, and refused, and then Shiv blew the whistle and was moved on as well. So we hope that he'll be touring Australia shortly to following a trip to New Zealand to tell his story here. Whistleblowers are not welcome in these places if they're going to speak up about what they know. Of course, people do retire, and it's amazing how many emeritus professors there are out there, you know, spilling the beans about what they know about what goes on in these industries and in these research institutions once they've retired and are essentially immune from any retribution.
Indeed. Bob, are there any other major players in the genetically modified food industry other than Monsanto? Because I only hear about Monsanto. Do they have any competitors?
Oh, well, Bayer's fairly large, but Monsanto is by far the largest, although, of course, it licenses its products and its genes. So not all Roundup-tolerant crops are actually done by Monsanto. At the moment, we've got two or three other companies in Australia using the Monsanto technology, paying a fee for using it, and selling their products. So it's a Monsanto product. Monsanto has an interest in it by virtue of having a patent on the gene. but the actual legwork is done by other companies. We saw something similar with the genetically manipulated cotton when it was introduced in 1996 into Australia. The CSIRO and the Cotton Foundation were very involved in doing the research, getting Monsanto's genes into the local varieties of cotton. Monsanto did contribute some funds, but not massively. But then, of course, when the cotton varieties were commercialized, Monsanto was in a position then to say, well, yep, that'll be $245 a hectare royalty, thanks very much, and reaped a bonanza. In fact, it was more than the market could bear because the farmers found that they actually couldn't make a profit at that level, and it went down to $155. But more recently, Monsanto has introduced its two-gene cotton because the insects from the original variety started to become resistant to being zapped by this insect toxin built into the plant. They then put two BT genes into the cotton, and most recently, the last season, the cotton seed was $300 a hectare, and they bumped it up to $315, which again has caused cotton growers to squirm right royally because it was more than the market could bear. You know, cotton growers were not going to make a profit out of growing cotton because most of the money, as happened with the GM crops in Canada, goes into the pocket of the owner of the technology. For instance, a European study of the introduction of the GM canola into Canada found that between 1995, when it was introduced, and 2000, Monsanto got 94% of the take, and the farmers got 6%, and of course the shoppers got zero. They only got the risk because the price of food didn't go down at all. Later, farmers got 30% and the company 70%, because again, the farmers couldn't bear the strain of not getting any benefit out of the fact that they were growing Monsanto's product.
It just seems ridiculous. I mean, honestly, it's farcical on one level. But I mean, obviously, a lot of people take it all very seriously, and it's, you know, it's no joke. But I mean, there's got to be a better way. I've just got a couple more questions.
The better way is spelled out, of course, in a very major UN report came out last year, the IAASTD report, which reviewed the future for agriculture worldwide over the next 20 years. And the way that we have to go is get off the oil treadmill, forget about GM. It's not going to make a useful contribution to the future of agriculture. And get serious about building sustainable systems for growing what we need for food and fiber production worldwide, and particularly in, say, the African situation, not trying to steamroll African farmers into accepting a North American system of broadacre agriculture, which dispossesses large numbers of people of their land and sends them into the slums and cities, involves the laser leveling of huge tracts of land, the use of huge machinery, chemicals, and patented seed. That's not the way to go. Africa has many, many culturally based appropriate systems of farming that, of course, have been overridden by the indebtedness of that continent and the introduction of cash crops like sugar, tea, coffee, and so on, that people have not been able to feed themselves properly because these cash crops have been attractive to large landowners who send the products off overseas while local people starve. We need to get back to the idea that diverse systems of agriculture are appropriate, and that these huge monocultures of the kinds that we have in Australia are part of the problem. They're destroying soils, We're mismanaging water. They're polluting waterways and the environment. And it's simply unsustainable. We need a better way, and we should be investing our scarce research and development resources not into Mickey Mouse technologies like gene manipulation, but into smart systems for the management of our land. Farmers of the future are going to have to wear two hats. They need to be great land managers, preserving biodiversity on behalf of all of us, whether we live in cities or the country, because those are our natural environments on which we depend. So they've got to be good land managers, and also, of course, have got to feed and clothe and house us as well from their products.
We need
to get more clever and not be relying on these oil running out and these silly high technologies that do not work.
The approach that you're describing there also sounds like it could have a benefit for the people who live in rural areas, for their own community, because what's happened with the high-tech approach is that it's isolated farmers more and more, because everything's done with expensive equipment, expensive machinery, everything's expensive. They can't afford to have many people. It seems to have been this increasing isolation and, you know, basically people leaving rural areas and making it harder and harder for farmers to function. I'm sure on an emotional level as well as any other level, it must just get harder and harder to function.
Well, on every level, farmers are squeezed from both sides.
Yeah.
Farm machinery, more expensive. Farm fuels, more expensive. Pesticides and herbicides, more expensive. Seed, more expensive. So the input side is squeezing them tighter. And on the output side, you've got the supermarkets and the grain traders and the big people who squeeze the farmers. The farmers generally are price takers. We've just seen Warrnambool cheese and butter cut 30% off the price of milk that it pays to its milk suppliers in a day recently. Of course, they had other options and many of them have deserted that particular company. But generally speaking, if you look at it over the last century, say in the early years of the 20th century, the input side got about 30% of the take, farmers got 30%, and the people on the other end, the supermarkets and the traders and so on, got 30% of the action as far as agriculture was concerned.
Right.
Now, the input and the output side, most of which is owned by the same companies, whether it's on the input or the output side, have squeezed the farmers so tight that if they can get 2 or 3%, they're damn lucky.
Mm.
And they might get a negative most of the time, particularly with things like drought. So they've become essentially serfs, standing up plants in fields in service of these large corporations on the input and the output side, doing, you know, like in the case of the GM crops, you're told when to plant them, when to spray them, when to harvest them, and what price you're going to get. So really, you know,
the whole expertise,
farmers are not autonomous.
Knowledge has been kind of moved out of the picture, and they're just becoming, yeah, as you say, sort of vassals to the feudal corporate structure.
So you're right. I think a more robust approach to rural communities making their own decisions and being less dependent on all of those inputs would be a great thing for the future. And, of course, there are people moving back to rural cities and towns, and that's a great trend. But it mustn't just be for the lifestyle. It's got also to be the creation of genuine rural communities that are supportive of those productive people.
It has to be an economically sustainable activity, not just retirees moving to the country, you know, to enjoy
it. Housing there is cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
one more thing I want to address, because we're probably running to the end of time here and it is getting late. Just this question of the hoarding of seeds and the Terminator seeds that Monsanto seems to be focusing on. I mean, the issue of Monsanto buying up seed stock and seeming to want to own virtually the entire genome, and this issue of Terminator seeds, which I don't know too much about, but I understand that increasingly they're selling seeds that will not re-sprout once they've grown. Is that correct?
No, that's not really quite right.
Okay.
The Terminator doesn't exist. It's an idea that was developed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and a company in the USA. For the idea was, yeah, exactly, to build into a seed a gene which would prevent that seed from re-germinating. So the plant would grow once and then the gene would kick in and render the seed of that plant sterile so that it couldn't be replanted. It's still in the nature of a good idea from their point of view, but a horrific idea from the point of view of humanity.
Okay, so this has not happened yet.
Most people. However, okay. Certainly our own regulator, the Office of Gene Technology Regulator, has said that they've got no objection in principle to Terminator, and neither does our government. And if they ever got an application for Terminator technology, they would certainly entertain it.
Right.
Of course, we're already in that, a little bit in that realm, in that farmers do have to go back and buy seed. For example, if they grow hybrids, which are specially manipulated, not using GM, to be more productive, but only more productive for one season, then it means that farmers are dependent on having to go back to buy seed as well. Of course, there are new varieties arriving all the time. And as well as the patent system, we also have plant breeders' rights, which is an intellectual property control system here in Australia as well, which means that any product, any seed that's the product of even conventional breeding can be registered under plant breeders' rights, and then fees are charged. And if it's an annual, then, of course, you would have to go back and buy the seed again. So ownership and control of the means of producing our food and our fibre is a present reality, and we have to, I guess, deal with that. But I think the addition of a technology that also deliberately sterilised a plant and made its seed incapable of regerminating is simply beyond the pale, and certainly there'll be another attempt at the Convention on Biological Diversity meeting, which will take place in Europe around about this time next year. We will be doing two things, trying to get Australia to take a position of opposition, which is shared by a large number of other countries, to the Terminator technology. And secondly, we will be attempting to get the Australian government to become a party to the biosafety protocol. This is a protocol that was negotiated under the Convention on Biodiversity, which aims to set up mechanisms for the safe international transfer, handling and use of genetically manipulated organisms. And along with Canada, USA and Argentina, Australia has been stoutly refusing to become a party to that protocol, and we hope that that policy will be reversed.
And just one last question on that, the issue of the hoarding of seed stock. Is that actually something that Monsanto is doing?
Well, they're in the business. They've become, you know, they've got into the seed business. They've got out of chemicals, except from Roundup, and they've got into gene manipulation, and they've also, of course, as a result of being very cashed up, been looking for companies to buy, and so they have bought probably in excess of 50 different seed companies around the world over the last decade or so, and they did buy the largest fruit and vegetable seed company in the world a few years ago, so they are now the biggest owner of commercial seeds on the planet, and that gives them an immense amount of power and control. And, you know, we're not convinced that Monsanto will necessarily exercise its power and control responsibly. For instance, some North American farmers are now saying that they've had it with gene-manipulated crops and they want to go back to the conventional varieties. But unfortunately, what they're finding is that the conventional varieties are not available. They're simply not for sale anymore. And some Canadian growers have said the same. So that kind of, the exercising of that kind of control is not in the public interest, and it does give them a tremendous amount of power over food production worldwide. And I just think that governments need to step in and take some of that power and control back.
Indeed, indeed. Thanks for that. Sorry, I just had a bit of a problem there with someone was banging on the door. I hope that didn't get into the audio.
All right, time to go.
Look, that has been absolutely superb. Really, thank you very much for that.
It was really long. Where does it go to air at such length? You have to be pretty brain dead to listen to that something that long.
Well, I think I think it'll be people will be interested.
Okay.
We have a listenership. We've got quite a lot of people subscribing to the RSS feed of the podcast. And,
so they listen online. It's not broadcast.
It's just on the internet. Yeah, one day we'd really like to get a radio station, and we're going to keep doing it. Maybe something will turn up. A community radio station might take it up.
To SCR or something.
Yeah, that's certainly something we'd love to do.
Yep. Oh, good. All right. Well, thanks, Harrowood. That's good. Let's know how your show goes. Sounds good, and I think other people are showing some interest in showing the DVD as well. Where did you actually get that copy of the DVD?
The DVD, I first heard about it on an internet radio program that I listen to quite a lot.
So did you get one from the makers, did you actually get it off the web?
I just heard about it, and I listened to an interview, and then I got online and I did a search, and I found the page of Seeds of Deception where they were selling it. And then I ordered the DVD, and so now we're doing a screening of the film, which is a really excellent
film.
What
did it cost?
I actually bought a large box full of DVDs and brochures and flyers, so it was it was about $150, but it was about 10 DVDs and a book and a whole lot of things. It was actually a really good bundle of stuff. So that's what
we're
using.
Would you mind sending me down the URL, because I know there are other people interested in that.
Absolutely, we'll do that.
Okay,
we'll do
thanks.
That. And look, again, if you anyone else that you'd like to contact in regarding to the film screening, this is going to be an excellent opportunity to share information.
I've sent it out, so if I can't do more, I probably won't send it again. I think it's on our calendar on our website, if I'm not mistaken.
Terrific. That is really excellent.
Good luck.
Thank you very much, Bob, and we'll talk again sometime.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity. Bye now.
Good night.
See ya.